ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. The second and third segment today, I'm pleased to have my conversation with James Corbett that we previously recorded on Wednesday evening. Always very pleasant to have a conversation with James. So first, we're going to do the market report for Friday, March 8th, 2019. And there's so much news today. I had a difficult deciding what to choose for the segments. Gold today was certainly in a bright spot to talk. New York spot price aftermarket, excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, we're up $14.40. So we're at $1,360. Silver had a nice day, a little over 2%, $15.42. Up 32 cents. Platinum was up $4 at 821. Palladium was down 14 at 1517. The USDX today was down 0.27 at 97.35. Crude oil was down 56 cents at 56.10. The paper markets today, they were triple digits all day long, 200 points, 250, but they brought them back. Last hour of trade. The Dow, 25,450, down 23. The NASDAQ, 7,408, down 13. And the S&P, 2,743, down 5. 10-year yield, 2.62%. And gold, as I mentioned, was 1,360, so a nice day for gold. Let's hope it can hold that 1,300 level, and I can't imagine this year. It's just going to be an incredible year for gold and silver. And yeah, I know it's frustrating because we understand, and I know all my listeners do, my clients do. They all understand what the dollar's doing. They all understand what the fiat currency is, and they all understand the value of gold and silver. And it's frustrating when we see it pull back, but it's a great buying opportunity. Don't let it discourage you. You go in and buy on the dips. If you haven't purchased yet, now's the time to do it. It's a great time to be buying your gold and silver. It's a savings account. It's something that you put away, something that preserves your purchasing power over a period of time. And we're going to talk about Kansas. They're going to be doing it. The state of Kansas released some information today. But first, let's go ahead and this was an interesting report. The jobs growth, remember we talked about the ADP report on Wednesday. They had they predicted that they'd have, 180,000 new jobs. Well, the government came out today, and it looks like the employment growth stalled a little bit in February, where the economy created only 20,000 jobs. This was reported by the Labor Department today, and it's the weakest since September of 2017. It also reflected a decline in hiring by retailers and utility companies, as well as the transportation and warehousing sector. And the warehousing, they're all experiencing a shortage of drivers. Job gains over the last 2 months averaged 186,000 per month. And let's see, then they tell us that they need 100,000 jobs to keep up with the working age population. The unemployment rate fell 0.2% to 3.8% in February. And let's see, now a broader measure of unemployment that includes people who want to work but have given up searching, and those working part-time because they cannot find full employment, that did drop, and it dropped significantly. It dropped to 7.3%, and this is the lowest since March of 2001. Now, what it was in January was 8.1%, so it was a nice drop, 8.1 to 7.3%. And this is the largest since the BLS has launched this series in 1994, this decline in the so-called U6 rate, so which is really the true unemployment rate. The labor force participation, or the proportion of working Americans who have a job or are looking for one, was unchanged last month at more than a five-year high of 63.2. So economists expect job growth to average about 150,000 this year. Let's see, and it shows that the employment at construction sites fell by 31,000. This was the biggest drop since December of 2013. The leisure and hospitality sector added no jobs after payrolls increased by 89,000 in January. The manufacturing sector created 4,000 jobs, the fewest since July of 2017. And the diffusion index of manufacturing employment, which measures the proportion of industries that show job gains during the month, that fell to 51.3 in February. So they're blaming the tariffs, the weakness in the CapEx and exports. Much of it is tied to knock-on effects from the tariffs, and the trade war confusion generally are likely behind the slowdown in hiring by the manufacturing sector. This is what they tell us. So they always have to come up for reasons other than, hey, the economy stinks, and this is going to be a continuing, it was never as good as what we were told that it was. And I was going to tell you about Kansas. The Federal Reserve continues manipulating interest rates in what many consider moves, designed or targeted the president in this roaring economy. But we knew they were going to be raising rates anyway, and the market itself sometimes can push these rates up. But when you live in a world of free money, yeah, any increase in interest rates is going to dampen your economy. But Kansas and other states are attempting to pass legislation that would strangle the fiat currency. Kansas House Representative Michael Capps, he introduced legislation, HB 2285, forcing the state of Kansas to recognize precious metals such as gold and silver as an official currency within the state. This would keep these precious metals from being taxed at the state level, and that allows the citizens to bypass the Federal Reserve by using an alternate currency for economic transactions and stores of wealth to protect their savings from Federal Reserve meddling. This legislation comes as President Trump, of course, we've seen him spar frequently with the Federal Reserve. And you have, of course, Ron Paul, former Texas representative. Of course, he endorsed the bill through his current organization, Campaign for Liberty. And he's telling everyone that support this legislation, you've got to pick up that phone and give them a call and try to, get this done. The Kansas Legal Tender Act would ensure a smoother transition from the Fed's fiat currency. Now, that's what I find interesting, that statement there. The Kansas Legal Tender Act would ensure a smoother transition. That means it's going to happen. By allowing a competing currency and legalizing gold and silver as money again. And should the bill receive a committee hearing from Kansas Taxation Chairman Stephen Johnson, it will then need a favorable vote to continue to the Kansas House floor before proceeding to the Senate. So there have been several states. We've talked about West Virginia. They have a similar bill. There's quite a few other ones. We've heard of Arizona, I think Utah. I'm not sure about Colorado, but there's been quite a few that have pushed to have gold and silver recognized as real money, as an official currency. And what I liked about this wording is that they're encouraging to use this alternate currency for economic transitions. So it's just not something you buy it, you put it away, and so forth. They're encouraging you to use it. So I think that is very interesting. You know, yesterday, hey, your tax dollars are always at work. Yesterday, we talked about all this frivolous spending. You have to spend the money to make sure that you get your budget money from the federal government. So I've seen several reports on the news programs and so forth, how lobsters and cars and desks and spend that money just so we can get more money in. Well, now here's something else that your tax money is going for. Transgender Iowans can use Medicaid funds to pay for transition-related care, including surgeries. This was according to a unanimous Iowa Supreme Court ruling on Friday. The court's decision strikes down the administrative code governing Medicaid in Iowa that classifies transition-related surgeries as cosmetic, reconstructive, or plastic surgery, and explicitly ban surgeries for the purpose of sex reassignments. The justices agreed that the rules contradicted protections in the Iowa Civil Rights Act. The law's gender identity classification encompasses transgender individuals, especially those who have gender dysphoria. Anyway, this was what was written by the Justice Susan Christensen wrote for the court. So the decision is thought to be the first by a state's highest court holding that transgender people have the right to use public money for transition-related surgeries. So your tax dollars at work, ladies and gentlemen. So what I want to know is, if you what other type of surgeries? I mean, can you get this plastic surgery done? Can old people get their eyes lifted and their cheeks lifted and their chins lifted and so forth now, if that makes us feel better and so forth? I don't know. But anyway, that area is not my expertise, but I know it's my expertise is I don't want my money being spent in this manner. I think if they're going to take my money, I think there's a lot of other areas more important that I would like to see it go to. But we don't have an option. The only thing that we can do is vote these politicians out of office. So there you go, Iowa. You have your task for you in the next election. But with the new House, Democrats that took over, we usually say that Congress never does anything and, they don't have anything to do and they'll go home on vacations. Well, I'll tell you what, the House is at least trying to pass some plans and they're certainly getting the votes for it. Now, whether it goes any further than this, and here is one. House Democrats pass a plan aiming to root out corruption and limit money in politics. Well, that's, we always have a problem with campaign finance. We should know they shouldn't be able to spend, billions of dollars to win elections anymore. The House Democrats passed a bill Friday aiming to reduce money in politics, expand voting rights, following through on their top policy priority since they gained control of the chamber. But here's the clincher. The proposal would also require presidential and vice presidential candidates to release their tax return. This is just a clear swipe at President Trump. I mean, they're going to do anything and everything. The plan, which is a key plank of Democrats' 2018 strategy known as H.R. 1, passed the chamber by a 234-193 party-line vote. With the proposal, Democrats hope to cast themselves as the party better equipped to root out corruption. I mean, this stuff, you can't make this stuff up, ladies and gentlemen. They are the better party. Let's go back and look at the party and see the corruption. Let's not forget about just the Obama administration, the Fast and Furious, the IRS tax problem, Hillary and her computers and emails. I mean, Solyndra. I mean, how many more can you go on? And yet they're the best ones they are better equipped to root out corruption. Maybe they're better equipped to root out corruption because maybe they are corrupted themselves. So they're able to spot it. Not that they're holier than thou and thinking that, you know, they're so good that they can see it. You know, they're actually putting their, you know, exposing themselves to the to their corruptness. But they said that they're better equipped to root out corruption and boost participation in the U.S. political system. The plan was overshadowed for most of the week by the anti-hate measure passed yesterday, which in response to comments from Omar, Representative Omar in Minnesota, that various critics deemed anti-Semitic. The Democrats' ethics reform bill has little chance of becoming law. Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has lambasted the measure as a federal grab, power grab by the Democrats, and President Trump has also threatened to veto this legislation. So, but it is massive, and in it, as far as the finance, campaign finances, it would require so-called dark money groups, which do not have to disclose their donors, to reveal their sources of funding, which setting up a public funding method for congressional campaigns. It would create a national automatic voter registration. This is the classic part. Make Election Day a federal holiday. Those federal employees, they'll do anything to have a federal holiday, won't they? So let's just make Election Day a federal holiday and boost early voting and same-day registration. And if that's not wacky enough, they also voted today to defend localities, your local governments, that allow illegal immigrants to vote in their elections. You know, it's like these people, they're insane. I mean, they're just in there doing all this legislation. They'll never get passed. They'll never get through the Senate. They'll never become a bill. It'll never get, you know, President Trump will just veto it. And it's like, what are they doing? But you know what? You can throw a lot of things on the wall and just hope something sticks. And I think this is what they're doing. They're just hoping something somewhere in the election cycle, voters, their constituents, will remember that, well, they tried, so we're going to, you know, and maybe this is that way. Let's just throw everything and hopefully we'll get something. I don't know how many of you know Judge Napolitano. He's a Fox News commentator, and he had made a statement that President Trump has had a bad week and that he's hoping that you know, he's going to be able to recover, and hopefully that it's not going to continue, and I'm not going to continue because we're out of time, but the program is going to continue with James Corbett just as soon as we come back from this break. And thank you for listening to Financial Survival.
We will find you acting on your best
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. And I'm pleased to welcome back to the program today James Corbett. And as we know, James is the founder and the editor of the Corbett Report that was founded in 2007. And in 2012, James became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster that was created by economic analyst and our friend Bob Chapman. And please, ladies and gentlemen, make sure you visit James' website at thecorbettreport.com. That is thecorbettreport.com. And if you'd like to have a complimentary issue of the International Forecaster, you can go to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. And hello, James.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Oh, well, it's wonderful to have you. And let's get started right away. And I'm not going to ask you the normal question, but...
I'm actually ready for it in case. But
are you really?
I am.
No, I'm going to throw you out. There was an article on the website of2minds.com that asked what killed the middle class. And the article points out that wealth concentration, that is income inequality, has returned to levels not seen since the 1920s. Is the middle class dead? Is it dead here in the U.S.? Is it dead around the world? And is it going to improve?
Well, that is a heady opening question.
How
isn't
about
it?
That? I'm getting right to the...
Right into the heart of things. Well, I don't want to oversimplify things in this answer, and I don't want to go in half-cocked, not having really researched or thought about this. But just thinking about it broadly, I would say that our conceptions of middle class and upper class and lower class are necessarily changing, because the fundamental underpinning of the economy itself is changing. And one of the kind of catchphrase slogans that's been being thrown around increasingly to try to encapsulate what's happening in that transition is data is the new oil. I had a podcast episode on that very topic years or so ago, data is the new oil. But it's getting, even that phrase is being used so much that it's now getting a lot of kickback. There was a recent Wired article, for example, no, data isn't the new oil. But clearly that's gesturing towards something important about the way the economy as we know it is changing. It's becoming less dependent on the traditional industrial manufacturing processes that have undergirded the economy in the industrial and post-industrial world. But... it is now moving towards data itself, data about you and the way that you do things and what you are doing and when and with whom is becoming a type of currency in the economy, which necessarily changes the way the economy itself is structured. So, of course, one of the ways that this is being felt is in the destruction of what was a comfortable and secure blue-collar, working-class lifestyle that existed at some point in the post-war period, say, in the United States, where there was a path for someone with, say, high school-level education to work a comfortable enough, or to work a job, we'll say, a blue-collar job in manufacturing of some sort, and to live a comfortable enough life to support a family and to have children and go on vacation for a couple weeks a year, et cetera, et cetera. The American dream, as it were. Well, maybe that's not the ultimate encapsulation of that dream, but it's, I think, part of it. The idea that you could at least support a family and make a living. That is going away, and everyone, I think, understands that and is feeling that, and that's what a lot of the anxieties around issues like immigration, illegal and legal, the H-1B, I'm going to get that wrong off the top of my head, those visas for immigrants to come in, offshoring of jobs. A lot of these types of tensions are around that fundamental displacement of that from the economy. And that, I think, was one of those things that propped up what we thought of in the past as the middle class versus the upper class versus the lower class. You could be blue collar and be in the comfortable lower middle class, we'll say. At any rate, you would have a shot at that. At this point, it's becoming harder and harder to envision that kind of lifestyle, and now we're seeing the fight for 15 and these types of minimum wage movements arising around the fact that, well, low-skilled and low-paid labor now has a little chance of getting anywhere, let alone even supporting themselves, let alone a family. So I think we have to, at the very least, we have to fundamentally re-evaluate what middle class means in the current economic climate, and whether it's still valuable as a way of viewing the people's position in this economy. So that's my first stab at an attempt at answering a question like that. But as you can see, it brings in about 8,000 other relations that we have to take into account here. At any rate, I think what we used to think of as the upper, middle, lower class distinctions is changing, and not necessarily for the better for a lot of people who used to fit into that middle class lifestyle, who are increasingly being pushed further down that ladder.
What are governments going to be doing when you have so many of these jobs being replaced by technology, automation, robots? And it's not that it's going to be, you know, 40 years from today that all this is happening. I mean, we're talking about now. We're talking about people's jobs. I'm reading where these, and I've talked about this earlier on my programs, you have these corporations, they're restructuring. They're eliminating positions. It's cheaper. They're spending millions and millions of dollars on severance pays to eliminate the human. And I'm assuming that what they're doing is they're restructuring. They're retooling. They're revamping. They're upgrading their technologies. So it's happening now. And these are companies that are making profits. It's not that they're bankrupt or anything. So and governments have no idea what they're going to do with people that.
Well, they do have some ideas, and in fact, that's what's worrying to me. It's something that I've written about in the Forecaster before, is universal basic income,
right,
is an idea that's being, right, increasingly kicked around as the solution to this. Well, what are governments going to do as there is increasingly less and less avenues for people who are not highly technically skilled to make their way in the economy? Of course, this gives rise to the learn-to-code meme, which people might have picked up on the internet. If not, basically, in the wake of coal miners and others being put out of work, we've seen a lot of journalists writing these think pieces for the New York Times and other mainstream publications. Well, you know, the coal miners just need to learn to code and become, you know, software engineers or whatever. Just ridiculous, trite advice from cushy journalists living in a bubble, which, of course, has backfired as people now, when journalists are going out of work and are increasingly being displaced out of their jobs by the dinosaur media just going extinct, people are tweeting learn to code at them and then being suspended from Twitter because it's seen as harassment. But all of this is to say, I mean, there are few options. There are few realistic options for people, especially people who are deep into their career in what used to be a, if not comfortable, at least plausible lifestyle of in the manufacturing sector, who are now out of work and struggling. And that's, as you say, only going to increase because of technological concerns. So what do we do in this situation? Well, one of the only solutions that is being talked about on a global level now and in the highfalutin conferences at Davos and others is universal basic income, which, of course, for people who don't know, is the idea that the government provides a stipend to every citizen. And generally, this is what is meant by UBI, hence universal. Every single citizen, regardless of who you are, what you do, what, how much money you're making, gets a certain amount of money from the government each month, each 2 weeks, each year, however they disperse it, just as a sum package, no strings attached, just money deposited into your account for you to use any way you want. And the idea here is that, well, I mean, government can make manna rain down from heaven, so why not rain it down on people rather than into the coffers of big banks when they come out with trillion-dollar bailouts? Well, why not just actually give this spend it into the economy, into people's accounts, where they will then spend it on real products and services, and it will at least have a real effect on the economy. And there are a lot of things to be said about this, which, again, I have written about before. I did an article called Universal Basic Enslavement, where I think you get my take on this proposed quote-unquote solution, which is essentially no strings attached, always has strings attached. And as you're starting to see creep into the conversation about universal basic income that's being held at these highfalutin conferences and in these academic debates and others, it's increasingly people are saying, well, I mean, there has to be some restrictions, and maybe we could tie it to, for example, make sure everyone has their mandatory vaccines or something along those lines. You know, we have to tie some sort of civic duties to the universal basic income. So I think ultimately this is just going to be the central planner's ultimate dream, is to be able to control the economy and people in a way never before really possible, in at least in the United States, by literally controlling people's income, deciding how much you're going to get because the robots are taking all the jobs. I'm not sure I have an alternative solution to these quandaries. I mean, these are assuming things continue as they are going, and as we know, with technological development, it generally develops at an exponential rate. So, you know, 5 years from now, it's going to be crazy. 10 years from now, it's going to be 10 times crazier. 20 years from now, it's going to be 1,000 times crazier. So, are we really ready for this? No, we're not. But I don't think universal basic income is going to be the magic solution to all of this. And of course, it brings in a lot of questions of its own about inflation and how the economy really works. So, in short, yes, the government has ideas about what ways they might approach this, but I do not think those are going to be very helpful ideas.
Well, I can't even imagine how governments could even attempt it, considering all governments are broke.
But you see, the point of universal basic income is that it's largely popular with people who are advocating modern monetary theory, MMT, which is the buzzword surrounding a new group of thinkers who are coming along with some old Keynesian verities, but they have a new spin on it. Basically, their point is that, well, the government can't go broke because they print the money.
Right. Yes.
And their point is that it doesn't matter if there were $2 in debt or $2 trillion in debt or $200 trillion in debt, the government can print that into existence. They will never go broke to themselves. And there is a certain logic to what they're saying. I think it does not take into account the deeper complexities of the global economic system and what it's structured on. But there, as we've talked about before, there is an appreciable extent to which the international monetary order is based on faith. As long as people buy into the system and believe in the system, it can be propped up by just adding more zeros into people's bank accounts. You know, what does it really matter in the end whether you're holding a dollar bill or a $1,000 bill? It's just the value that you ascribe to that. And I think that's...
And as long as you're getting those zeros, you're going to accept it and believe in it.
Well, exactly, right. As long as the system seems to be ticking along, people are happy enough to go along with it until the point at which it hits crisis. And that's the thing that can't really be predicted. It can be foreseen, but not necessarily. You can't say that the time and date that that's going to happen and how that's going to happen. But it has happened over and over throughout history. In fact, it's only a question of when. There's never been a fiat monetary system that's lasted forever. Every single one collapses in a hyperinflationary event eventually. Except, people would say, well, not the current incarnation of the U.S. dollar, the Federal Reserve note, etc. Well, I would just say, well, just let's sit back and watch for another decade or two or however long it takes. I mean, again, I think that they're trying to point to some false logic to say why this doesn't apply. But anyway, this is dressing itself up as a new economic school. And these MMTers and MMT proponents are the ones who I think are pushing for this idea of universal basic income.
There's a lot of people who believe we're at crisis level now. And predictions believe that, you know, things are going to, I mean, you hear everything from resets to Lord knows what. Are we that close? Or is this, you know, again, it's as long as that faith is there, they can take it for as long as they want.
Well, I've been doing this. I've been doing this long enough to know to avoid that question of how close we are.
I know. I have to.
Time will always make you into a fool at some point.
Because come on! I was trying to get you to.
Well, let me share this story instead. That was one of the because, as you say, Bob Chapman. I still am very honored that he chose me to succeed him as lead editorial writer for the International Forecaster back in 2012. But before that point, we were having regular weekly conversations on my podcast, and that was, of course, during the time of the Lehman collapse and the crisis and the so-called recovery. The jobless recovery and all of that. And at that time, I was always pressing Bob, you know, how long can they keep this going? And can, you know, when is it going to happen? When's the crash coming? And his point at the time was, you know, I've been around, I've seen this for decades and decades. They can keep it going for a long time. They have a lot of tricks left up their sleeve. I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. I was younger and greener at the time, so I was perhaps more impatient and thinking it was all going to happen in a matter of months or years at most. Well, clearly it didn't, and that was a piece of wisdom from Bob, which I now appreciate, that there are a lot of tricks up the sleeve, and it is so much based on faith. And as long as the public is tricked enough into going along with the system and the status quo and trusting it, then it will continue to function in some form or other. So, again, when and how does a public en masse lose trust in institutions and processes that have been there for their entire life or longer? It's not predictable. And so I can't predict that. And it's so much as dependent on particular circumstances and crises that come up out of nowhere, and then suddenly people realize that the emperor is wearing no clothes. So again, it's about the realization, and exactly how and when that will happen, no one really knows. But I do think it will happen.
You know, it truly is amazing, all the predictions out there, and I agree with you. They have incredible power and abilities to keep this thing going, but that doesn't mean people aren't hurt still along the way. We see the adjustments, you know, to jobs, to wages, to their pensions, and everything is up for grabs. And, you know, they get caught up that everything is going to be okay, and that's when really things happen. With all the news, with everything that's going on, you would have thought it would have broken that faith to some degree, and it truly is amazing that it hasn't. But yeah. Before we go into a break here, I don't know if we have time to start it, but in a recent article in your newsletter, you write about the International Criminal Court, and that you suggest is the real story behind it. You start your essay with these thoughts: throughout human history, victorious nations have gone too far in exacting revenge from their defeated foes. So I don't know if we should stop there.
I know the music is just about to start.
I know, that's why I'm talking real slow. But to quote the late Muhammad Ali, those are fighting words, mister, tell us what you mean. And that is just as history is written by the winners, so too is justice decided by the victors. And the case of the International Criminal Court is the prime example of that. And so we're going to go into a break with that statement and hear your response when we come back right after these few short messages.
Don't you lay it on the line? I need to hear it just one more time. Oh, won't you tell me again?
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey water filtration systems. The Berkey Light systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light system today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Heading into the break, we were talking about the International Criminal Court, and James, in the last Corbett Report newsletter, you write about the International Criminal Court, and you're going to tell us all about it when we came back.
And let's go. All right. Well, okay, so for those who don't know, of course, the International Criminal Court is a an international court, as the name implies, that was set up in The Hague. And I believe it started operations in 2003, was formally instituted in 2003, and since that time has investigated a number of situations for referral for international potential violations of international crime. So they have a list of situations on their homepage that you can go and read through that they've actually investigated. For example, alleged war crimes in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in 2004, or in northern Uganda in January of 2004. Or again in Uganda in the Central African Republic in 2007, Sudan in 2005, Kenya in 2010, Libya 2011, Cote d'Ivoire in 2013, et cetera, et cetera. A number of different situations have been investigated, but you will notice from that list alone that the ones that I've read so far, every single one of them being in Africa. Interesting. In fact, every single investigation that they've ever conducted has been with regards to Africa, except for one, which I believe was in Georgia. But other than that, every single investigation they've ever done is in Africa, which in and of itself is interesting, because if you were to think of violations of international law at least since the formation of the ICC in 2003, what would you think of? For myself personally, I would think of illegal wars of aggression committed by the United States and its allies in Afghanistan, in Iraq, based on premeditated lies about weapons of mass destruction, for example, that we now know as being premeditated lies. The indefinite detention of captives at Camp X-Ray and Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and other military prisons that resulted from those illegal wars, and the labeling of those captives as enemy combatants, highly legally questionable. You could think of Israel's use of white phosphorus in 2009 in Gaza. You could think of Saudi Arabia and its ongoing genocide, because that's what it is, in Yemen, that is actively being supported by the U.S. and its allies, the UAE and others. There's a lot of examples that you could think of, but not a single one of them has ever been referred to the ICC. ICC. Partly, that is a problem of jurisdiction, because, of course, the United States is not a signatory to the International Criminal Court. It's not a member. So it declares that it is beyond the purview of that court, and it sticks to that. For example, recently, back in 2017, the ICC opened a preliminary investigation into U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan, and they found a reasonable basis to believe that war crimes and crimes against humanity were committed in Afghanistan by U.S. forces. And so the prosecutor followed up by announcing that she was formally requesting an investigation by the ICC into those charges. But guess what? That's not going to happen, and it never was. But just to make sure that everyone understands that the U.S. is not going to be investigated by the ICC for anything. John Bolton, back when he was appointed national security advisor to the Trump administration, in his very first ever press conference, he made a point of that. He said, the United States will use any means necessary to protect our citizens and those of our allies from unjust prosecution by this illegitimate court. He added that the Trump administration will fight back against the ICC. And he said, we will not cooperate with the ICC. We will provide no assistance to the ICC. We will not join the ICC. We will let the ICC die on its own. After all, for all intents and purposes, the ICC is already dead to us. Which, well, it's no diplomatic mincing of words there. I think we get the message. And in a sense, it's one that I actually am not at odds with, because the question of international law and who holds the jurisdiction to prosecute people across international lines and under what circumstances and who's on that tribunal and all of those things is a very, very sticky question, and one with a big pedigree that I've gone into in my podcast before on the question of international law and who's really been formulating that. But that aside, at any rate, for anyone on the International Criminal Court, like one of the judges on the ICC, that was a pretty obvious sign that the ICC is not going to be able to live up to its mandate to actually prosecute international war crimes. And as a result, or international crime, I should say, not war crimes in particular. And as a result, recently, one of the judges on the ICC, a judge named Christoph Pflug, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, German, recently resigned from the ICC. He cited, well, that refusal by the U.S. basically to even be investigated for war crimes in Afghanistan specifically. He said the American security advisor held his speech at a time when The Hague was planning preliminary investigation into American soldiers who had been accused of torturing people in Afghanistan. The American threats against international judges clearly show the new political climate. It is shocking. I had never heard such a threat. So he was citing threats that he had received for, and others on the ICC had received for, even thinking about looking into prosecuting American crimes in Afghanistan. Well, as I point out in this article, although Christoph Pflug might not have heard of it before, others who have been involved in the International Criminal Court and around those workings in the past would have heard such threats before. And I have an example from my own interview archives. I interviewed a man named Christopher Black, who's a international criminal lawyer, who successfully defended a former Rwandan gendarmerie back at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And he talked about U.S. interference in that case back in the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. In that interview with me and in other places, he's talked about it, the interference that the U.S. brought to bear in the International Criminal Court. And this all goes around the fundamental premise of my article, which is the International Criminal Court is just a fig leaf for international justice. It's, of course, not justice in and of itself. It is just the token. Hey, look, we're providing justice, and we're going to prosecute the international criminals. It just happens that all the international criminals are Africans. You know, who would have thought? And that's, in some ways, that's even worse than not having the court at all, because without the court at all, at least people would understand there is no international justice being had. But when the court is there, it at least gives the impression to people who don't look deeply into these matters that there is some sort of, oh, there's an international criminal court. They look into these things. I guess nothing bad happened in Afghanistan or Iraq or anywhere else because, hey, look, they didn't prosecute it. When, of course, there's a much deeper story. So I think that's really the point of this. Justice in the international level is still just victor's justice.
Do you think there's any reason, the reason they target Africa might have to do with China? As China, you know, is trying to take a, you know, pretty strong appearance in that area, and you know, perhaps this is a way of keeping some sense of.
Yes. I mean, there is absolutely some element of that in some of the specific cases. For example, when we look at the Sudan and the sort of cause célèbre, quite literally, that occurred about a decade and a half ago, around Sudan and the horrible things that were happening there and the genocide and all of that, which was being hyped by people like George Clooney and others. But that was clearly the U.S. and their allies taking a certain side in that conflict in order to... it was essentially an oil war, and China was taking one side, and the U.S. and their allies were taking another. So the U.S. played the genocide card. And so the ICC investigation into Sudan certainly had that flavor to it. And that isn't to say that international crimes or crimes against humanity or whatever, you know, rubric you want to use didn't occur there. They almost certainly did. But it's a question of exactly when these things are prosecuted and, you know, when they are, when the court is willing to look the other way. And that is what Victor's Justice is about. It's like the war crime tribunals held in the Tokyo war crime tribunal, which prosecuted, of course, the Japanese for their war crimes, but the people sitting on it were U.S. military members who themselves had committed war crimes in the firebombing of Tokyo or the bombing of Dresden and other war crimes that occurred in World War II. Again, which war crimes get prosecuted and which ones get overlooked or airbrushed in the history books is just a matter of who ends up winning the war.
Wasn't the ICC supposed to play a very big part in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement? I believe that was one of the things that the they were to decide any situations that arose from the TPP and so forth. For some reason, nothing could be courts and everything couldn't be in the states. It would have to all be through the ICC.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, there was an international enforcement mechanism there. I would have to look it up again. I don't believe it was the International Criminal Court, but there was an international tribunal mechanism of some sort that people could appeal to under one of the clauses in that TPP, the way that it was presented before it was morphed into whatever it's becoming right now. But when that initial leak happened and we saw the clauses, one of them had to do with an international tribunal or international court of some sort. I don't believe it was the ICC itself, though.
Before we talk about Pakistan and India, I want to ask you about last week's Vietnam summit with President Trump and Kim Jong-un, and there was reports today of movement in North Korea's intercontinental ballistic facilities that would mean that they could be setting up for some missile testing. What's your take on that, if any? How's going to South Korea, Japan, and how, before we go into Pakistan, India, how does all that fit into an equation?
Yeah. Well, it's difficult to know at this point. I haven't seen those reports specifically they're referring to, so I'm not going to comment on them until we know something more substantial, because there's always reports of suspected activity here and there, and we'll see what actually eventuates from it. Could North Korea resume missile testing as a result of collapse of talks in Hanoi? It's potentially possible. I think, ultimately, it's not particularly surprising to me that North Korean U.S. talks seem to have stalled at this point, because it was never seriously on the table that there was any sort of agreement here. It was always just going to be, you're going to disarm and then we'll talk about getting rid of sanctions. And realistically, from an objective third point of view, it would be absolute ridiculous nonsense for the North Koreans to accept such a agreement from a state that has just recently pulled out of one of its other agreements with another arming nuclear power / nuclear energy proponent, Iran, over what the U.S. even admitted was not a breach of the agreement, but they just pulled out of it unilaterally. Why would anyone negotiate with that state in good faith? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So I don't think there was any ever serious offer on the table to work with here at all. But to me, the most important point of this process is the at least the easing of tensions between North and South Korea, and the ability to create a space for North and South to come together at the table and start hammering out some agreements on their own. And if this does nothing else than give Kim and Moon at least the space to meet more frequently and exchange information and at least begin that process, then it will have been worth something.
Well, I want you to talk about Pakistan and India before we run out of time. I hope we had a little more.
Yes.
you have tell the listeners about how they can read at your website. Tell us about
Okay. Well, I am going to be writing about this in the International Forecaster this weekend. So, of course, you can pick up the International Forecaster. As you say, you can get a free introductory copy at theinternationalforecaster.com, and they always post my lead editorial there every weekend. You can also read my newsletter on my website, CorbettReport.com. To read my newsletter, you need to be a subscriber to my website. But as I say, the International Forecaster is freely available. That editorial is freely available. And I'm going to be writing about what's been happening in India and Pakistan, specifically in Kashmir, over the past few weeks. And people might have heard that there was an attack on Indian forces in February 14th, a suicide bombing of a bus that was carrying some Indian paramilitary police reserve officers, killing 40 people. At least that's the story as we understand it. And then India, of course, had to respond militarily. Especially because there is an election coming up soon in which the Modi government is fighting for its political life. So, as always, a little bit of military action is always good to rally people around the flag and make them feel good about the government. So, some sort of military response is going to come. And so, of course, we saw, India responding with an airstrike, over Pakistan, actually breaching Pakistani airspace. Which led to a shoot down of a MiG-21 by Pakistani fighters and just a lot of craziness. One of the aspects of that craziness is the fact that India has claimed that they struck this compound, this madrasa that was training the suicide bombers in Pakistan. They claim they destroyed the site and killed hundreds of would-be terrorists. Pakistan laughed at that and said that's fake news. Well, now Reuters is coming out with satellite photos that seem to show the site and not a single crater, no damage, nothing whatsoever to show that there was any strike whatsoever of any sort. So it looks like India was lying about the fact that their airstrikes were successful. So this is going to add another layer to this story. And this, of course, all comes in the background of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor and America calling it the Indo-Pacific instead of the Asia-Pacific, and India and Pakistan and their relationship to China and the U.S. It's a big mess. So I'm going to be sorting that out in the newsletter this week.
Well, it sounds like a very interesting read, ladies and gentlemen. So make sure you get a free complimentary copy of the InternationalForecaster.com or go to theCorbettReport.com. And thank you so much, James, for joining us. We'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks. And thank you all for tuning in today. So until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.